Good morning, all. Our first case for argument this morning is Annex Books versus the City of Indianapolis. Mr. Murray.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Murray and I do represent the appellants. I would like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Your Honors, as you know, twice before in published opinions, this court held that the city's evidence in support of the ordinance challenged here was insufficient under intermediate scrutiny to justify the closing hours of the adult bookstores. The critical issue in this appeal depends upon whether the evidence offered in the court below on remand cured the deficiencies outlined in those two previous opinions. We submit that the answer to that question is no, and that beyond that, the plaintiffs offered additional evidence further undermining the city's rationale and supporting our claim that the ordinance violates the First Amendment.
Mr. Murray, did the plaintiffs introduce any evidence as to how the crime rate at the adult bookstore locations compared to that of other businesses that are open at those late hours, such as convenience stores or gas stations?
The only evidence in the record, Your Honor, that was offered on that subject shows that the CVS drugstore, for example, that was near Keystone had far greater crime rates than did Keystone Video, including far greater number, like three times greater crime, and had far greater number of robberies even. And, of course, CVS is not a business protected by the First Amendment. It is not regulated by the hours. Menards was another business. That one was near Annex Books, and the city's exhibit M6 showed that Menards had like 149 crimes during the pre-enforcement period compared with something like 9 at Annex Books, and Menards had something like 2 or 3 times the number of robberies than did Annex, and yet Menards is not required to be closed. And keep in mind, Your Honor, the way I read your the opinions in the two cases before, it really was the city who should have shouldered the burden to compare what the crime rate at the bookstores was with respect to that to other retail businesses, because you may recall in the very first opinion that you rendered, one of the criticisms of the city's reliance upon the 41 arrests at Annex Books for public masturbation was that the record didn't show whether that's a large or small number, and the record didn't show how it compared to arrests for drunkenness and disorderly at bars and taverns that can remain open past midnight and on Sundays. And so in the absence of a comparative evidence, I believe that this court held that the city had not met its burden. As I said, Your Honor, we offered additional evidence which we believe supported the ordinance. Just as an example, we offered the testimony of two vice officers who over many years had investigated undercover the four bookstores here. They both affirmed that there was no evidence of drugs, prostitution, drunkenness, disorderly conduct, or other vice crimes at any of the three stores that are retail only and had no video booths. And even as to Annex, there was no evidence of prostitution, drugs, drunkenness, or disorderly conduct. And they answered the question posed by this court's first opinion as to whether any of the arrests for public masturbation at Annex occurred during the hours of midnight to 10 or on Sunday. The answer was no.
Now, how then do you respond to the city's argument that the crimes at or near the adult bookstores in the overnight and Sunday hours are actually higher than any of the statistics because the vice unit didn't work after midnight or on Sunday?
Well, it's true they testified that they didn't work after midnight or on Sunday, but it remains the fact that there's no evidence that there were any of those arrests during those hours, and they testified that the entire problem of public masturbation had been eliminated because of the open booth requirements. Now that the doors are off the booth, they testified that they don't have any problems even during the daytime. So currently, according to the record, there is no problem at Annex that would justify any closing hours between midnight and 10 a.m. or on Sunday, because the problem that they pointed to has been completely eliminated, according to the testimony of the officers. And, of course, the city never even undertook the task of comparing the arrests at Annex with any other businesses such as bars and taverns, as this court indicated it should, in order to evaluate whether those numbers were meaningful at all. So the city has shifted entirely from the argument that, based on the 2009 crime study. You may recall that their crime study in 2009 actually showed that crime went up rather than down in the 500-foot vicinity of the bookstores after the ordinance went into effect. However, your opinion indicated that you doubted that the numbers were sufficiently large to be statistically significant. And we answered that question. We had Dr. Linz do the calculations, and your suspicion was confirmed. The numbers were not large enough to be statistically significant.
But even if the reduction in the number of crimes is slight or was slight during the overnight hours, if the types of crimes reduced, or particularly serious ones such as armed robberies, isn't the impact on the community significant?
Your Honor, the problem with that, their reliance upon that evidence, and that is primarily their argument here. They've shifted, and you're right, they primarily argue that the reason that these stores have to be closed is to reduce the number of times that they will become victims of robbery. There are a number of answers to that question. The first of which is that that argument collides directly with this court's opinion in Annex 2, which reaffirmed the holding in the New Albany case and reiterated, quote, that readers may decide for themselves what risks to run, and cities must protect readers from robbers rather than reduce risks by closing bookstores. So that's one of the answers to that question, is that it collides with Your Honor's opinion in Annex 2. But again, the numbers are so small that even Dr. McCleary agreed that the change was not statistically significant, even in the aggregate. Let alone, and he says that you shouldn't even do it in the aggregate. You need to analyze it per store. And when you do that, if you look at the exhibit that the city relies most heavily upon, Exhibit M4, which is reproduced at pages 6 and 7 of our reply brief, it shows that the numbers are extremely small and cannot be regarded as statistically significant. For example, at Lafayette Video, it went from 5 crime incidents during the overnight hours to none, a difference of 5. On Sunday, 1 before, 1 after, the same. At New Flix, there were none between midnight and 10 a.m. in the pre-enforcement hours, but 1 afterwards, so it actually went up by 1. Sunday, 0 and 0. Keystone, there were 3 in the pre-enforcement hours, crime incidents there, between midnight and 10 a.m., according to the city's exhibit, and 3 afterwards, no change. On Sunday, there were 5 before and 2 afterwards, a change of 3. And we're talking about 3.5-year periods. We're not talking about over a small period of time. We're comparing 38 months to 34 months. And then Annex went from 3 to 1 in the midnight overnight hours, and on Sunday went from 1 to 0. Again, clearly not statistically significant. At Video Gallery, the last bookstore they studied, which is not a plaintiff, in the overnight hours it went from 1 to 0, and on Sunday it went from 1 to 0. So these numbers are so small, not only are they not statistically significant, but they're not even statistically significant in the aggregate, because that's what they point to. They aggregate all 5 of those, and they say that it went from a total of 12 in the overnight hours down to 5 and 8 down to 3 on Sunday. But even in the aggregate, Dr. McCleary acknowledged that they were not statistically significant. So those numbers are inadequate to justify the ordinance. And again, it doesn't even respond to the requirement. You know, it's no, as Justice Kennedy said in his concurrence in Almeida Books, and as you pointed out in your prior opinions, it's no trick to reduce secondary effects by reducing speech. So you would expect that if you close the bookstores, crimes that can only occur if the bookstore is open should go down, and yet they hardly went down at all. But it's no trick to reduce secondary effects that way, and you can't do it that way. The other problem is that the city never did compare this reduction in crime to what was going on at other similar retail outlets that don't sell books and magazines and videos. And this, of course, was necessary, the court said, in its first opinion. But again, as I pointed out before, the evidence that is in the record showed that the two stores that could be compared, both CVS and Menards, had far greater crime and had more robberies than did their nearby neighbors, Keystone and an Annex. And yet those stores, not engaged in First Amendment activity, are not required to close after midnight or on Sunday.
Is there any evidence, Mr. Murray, about the volume of traffic at those alleged comparative situations?
No, Your Honor, there really isn't.
So how do we draw from that any conclusion?
Well, it may be difficult, but I think that...
If you've got 1,000 people a day versus 15, what's your point about the Menard or CVS, which I suspect both of those might have higher traffic in a given 24-hour period than the bookstores?
Perhaps. I guess my point would be that the burden was on the city to do a comparison, as I read your prior opinions. And the criticism of the city in the very first opinion, when they relied upon the public indecency arrests at Annex, the criticism was that we don't know whether that's a large or small number, and we don't know how it compares. And until we have that information, evidence of crime at Annex Books in that case wouldn't even justify the ordinance, Your Honor said, even as to the store that had video viewing booths. So it seems to me that the risk of non-persuasion here, the risk that you might not be able to draw a reliable conclusion from the comparison of Menards and CVS to the bookstores, is a risk that falls to the city, not to the plaintiffs. The only thing the plaintiffs can point to is that those stores do have greater crimes, more robberies, but are not regulated by the hours of operation. The other point, Your Honor, that I wanted to make is the underlying police reports. The city spends a lot of time arguing that that's additional evidence, and it is. The underlying police reports were put into the record, but they don't help the city. They point out that there were 107 of them, violent person crimes, in the pre-enforcement period within 500 feet of the bookstores. They talk about the 21 of them that occurred at the bookstores, and we've dealt with that, and that leaves 86. We could find 79 narrative police reports with respect to those 86, and they're all described in the appendix at 63 to 70, and every one of those 79, domestic violence, you can read them for yourselves, but they all demonstrate that those 79 violent person crimes within 500 feet of the stores had no nexus to the existence of the stores, no relationship to the fact that the adult bookstores were there. And so we submit that the additional evidence that was in the record, which primarily consisted of Lynn Phelps's crime statistics that we put in, and the underlying police reports, which I've just described, and their effort to use those to demonstrate a not statistically significant small reduction in the aggregate of crimes at the stores, doesn't cure the deficiencies. And there's one more point I'd like to make before I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Sunday. Just about all of the evidence that they offered and relied upon and continue to rely upon is geared towards coming up with some justification for closing these bookstores between midnight and 10 a.m. There is nothing, nothing in this record that would support the proposition that on Sundays, all day, this ordinance can be justified by any public benefit. Even Dr. McCleary, if you read his testimony, did not offer a defense of that provision. He really was completely silent as to the Sunday closing hours. So that alone is clearly unconstitutional. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll reserve.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Mr. Bergholz?
Good morning. May it please the Court. After a full trial on the merits, where the district court was aided by additional evidence and by the opinion of both parties' experts, the court applied this court's standard in Annex Bucks 1 and upheld the city's hours of operation regulation as producing actual public benefits that were not outweighed by a substantial decrease in speech.
Could we go straight to Mr. Murray's last point, please, about the Sunday restriction? Because with respect to the Sunday restriction, the district court focused on violent crime. But rather than considering crime in the 500-foot surrounding area, the court focused more narrowly only on such crime as took place at the specific addresses of the bookstores. Won't that result in a self-fulfilling prophecy, in that crime will of course decrease at the business itself during hours at which it is closed and no one's there? I mean,
well, Your Honor, no, not necessarily, because there could be burglaries or other types of crimes when no one's there. But I think the important thing about what the record reveals is that although Sunday is 1/7 of the week and 14% of the days in the week, in the before period, 22% of the crimes, of the UCR Part 1 crimes at the adult bookstores, happened on Sunday. Afterwards, those UCR Part 1 crimes decreased by more than 50% at those adult bookstores, and the violent crimes went to zero. Ms. Kamens testified that Sunday was a busy day, sort of the critical mass theory that Justice Kennedy laid out in his concurring opinion. And 3 years before that, this court in Schultz versus City of Cumberland had upheld the identical hours of operation restriction, including the Sunday closure, as, quote, not substantially broader than necessary, even if more restrictive than absolutely necessary, end quote. And so all of the evidence in the record showed that not only was Sunday a disproportionate day for UCR Part 1 crimes, but the ordinance effectively reduced those Part 1 crimes.
But other than the statistics that are narrowly focused on the specific addresses of the bookstores themselves, is there any evidence that the Sunday prohibition reduced crime in the area?
Your Honor, the evidence showed that crimes that were unrelated to the adult bookstore went up. However, Mr. Murray wants to have his cake and eat it too. He wants to point to the non-adult bookstore address crimes on the before period and say if you exclude the 21 in the before period, then the other 86 aren't related to the store. But he can't do that and ignore that on the back end, in the enforcement period, the crimes were unrelated. And I think what's important about this is the district court properly, with the aid of both experts' opinions, discounted in the area. Some 50 to 60 times in the plaintiff's briefings, they talk about nearby, in the area. What they don't say is that capturing Menards and CVS, which are the only two stores that Mr. Murray talked about, they're not even within the 500-foot circles of these areas. The evidence showed, and this is both Dr. Lenz's testimony that Mr. Murray doesn't address, and Dr. McCleary's testimony that there are significant addressing and geolocating problems, especially with big box stores. Judge Flom asked the appropriate question. Menards is not only 650 feet away from an improperly drawn circle around Annex Books, but more importantly, it's a 100,000 square foot or more big box store with at least one's got to imagine at least 10 times the foot traffic of a small Annex Books. So not only is the comparison apples to oranges, but what Mr. Murray's relying upon is crime in the area that is really not within the circles.
But is there evidence in the record as to the crimes in the overnight hours that relate to the other businesses that are open 24 hours, such as the gas stations, the drug stores, the convenience stores? Because if the rate of violent crime in the overnight hours for adult bookstores is similar to that of gas stations or convenience stores, how could it be constitutional to close only the adult bookstores and impair First Amendment rights?
Well, there's a number of assumptions in that question. With regard to, with Your Honor, that Mr. Murray wants to indulge, but we can't, because the CVS store holds a state liquor permit. The city cannot do anything about taverns and bars because under state law, Indiana has the broadest preemption of local ordinances by a state legislature dealing with alcohol. So we couldn't regulate CVS hours of operations even if we wanted to because they're a liquor retailer permit. Menards, the other business he talked about, is a big box store that's not open past midnight. So what you do have is you do have convenience stores, you do have pawn shops, you do have liquor stores, and the comparison that is in Exhibit M6 satisfies both the threats to internal validity. Number one, the court properly found, based on the opinion of both experts, that the before-after analysis works because the sexually oriented business acts as its own control. And they also found that the hotspot ranking of comparing other businesses in the same census tract was an appropriate way to measure against those other locations. And in every one of the circles, the adult bookstore addresses were high on UCR Part 1 crimes, and in every single one of the circles, specifically with regard to armed robbery, they were number one or number two in all of those circles. And so these present the risk that the city, with an appropriately tailored regulation modeled after Schultz, addressed.
Yeah, but the armed robberies, when opened or when closed?
The armed robberies went down when closed during the they got the greatest reduction during the regulated hours. But the interesting thing is that, for example, on Sunday, the eight crimes beforehand, the majority of happened during the daytime. And then some happened at night. But what we got was a more than 50% reduction in all the Part 1 crimes, with the greatest reduction during the overnight hours. So the city's regulation was effective in reducing the secondary effects that it targeted. And I think what's most important about this is that the plaintiffs present no meaningful challenge to the district court's thorough analysis. They don't challenge, as a violation of clear error or as erroneous under that deferential standard, a single finding by Judge Barker, who listened to all the evidence and somewhat complicated testimony from the criminologists. Under the reasonably believed to be relevant standard endorsed by this court and the Supreme Court multiple times, a city only needs some evidence that fairly supports its regulation. It need not disprove alternative theories for the causation of secondary effects. And as this court held in Annex Books 1, cities are entitled to the benefit of the doubt. And that means that principles of federalism support experimentation. All that the city needs under Alameda Books is support for a theory that justifies its ordinance. And the district court, in a thoroughly reasoned analysis, not only found, based on both experts' testimony, that the city got a substantial reduction in the most serious types of crime during the regulated hours, but that further data that was explicated at the trial was the most reliable data in the record. The comparison in the surrounding areas basically falls apart under the district court's thorough analysis for all the reasons why that was not reliable data. Both experts said you need to read the actual underlying police reports, which only the city's expert did, the plaintiffs did not, and to make informed judgments about where crimes actually occurred. That's why focusing on the addresses is so important, because it's proof of actual causation, even though the city doesn't require, even though the courts do not require that. The facts are these. Less than 3% of these addresses in all four of the circles were represented by adult bookstores. Yet in the before period, those businesses accounted for 20% of all the violent in-person crime and 46% of all of the armed robberies. And they were a significant problem that the city properly targeted under an analysis endorsed by both experts. If I could address the statistical significance argument briefly, though, both experts endorsed a focus away from the raw numbers to an analysis of the severity and the seriousness of the underlying crimes. An armed robbery is qualitatively more serious than a shoplifting at Menards. In fact, a full 37% of all of the crimes in all four circles during the study period were shoplifting incidents at a big box store, Menards, that was outside any of the circles. Both experts said the most reliable information is from the reports to determine exactly where the crime happened, and that especially because of the rarity of crimes. In Indianapolis, a person would have to wait 245 years to be randomly the victim of an armed robbery. Yet, in 3 years, there were 18 armed robberies, and the plaintiffs want to treat themselves as victims. And to some extent, if you steal money from a store, the store is the victim. But the real risk is the gun that's put to the clerk's head, to the innocent bystander who's robbed at gunpoint, to all the law enforcement of the city that have to respond to that situation. And at page 36 of our brief, we give excerpts of the underlying police reports that show exactly how dangerous this evidence or these armed robberies are. And the district court properly weighted them according to both experts' testimonies. And this rarity argument collapses into the plaintiff's claims about statistical significance. First, statistical significance is not necessary under the Supreme Court's deferential, reasonably believed to be relevant standard that was followed by this court in GM Enterprises and the Benz Bar case. Number two, under the Matrix Initiative cases, statistical significance is not even necessary for adjudicative facts. What we're dealing here with is a predictive legislative judgment. But even in adjudicative fact situations, the Supreme Court has held that sometimes data is not of a sufficient quality to provide statistical significance. That was the case here. The unrefuted testimony in the record was that there were too many errors in the data in the 1.8 million records that was pulled that didn't allow for a proper statistical analysis. And then number two,
that worries me. You're saying that the data are so full of errors we can't really tell what they mean. Mm-hmm. That's why we don't have to rely on look for statistical significance. These are completely error-riddled, meaningless numbers. And then on the basis of these meaningless numbers, we want to restrict speech. Isn't that a problem?
No, Your Honor, and forgive me, I spoke lackadaisically. I should have said the machine-readable data. The problem was with the machine-readable data. Both experts testified to the district court that the way that you solve a lot of the problems is that you can take an excerpt of the underlying police of the actual police reports to solve those issues of where the crime was occurring, geocoding location problems such as coding to intersections or addresses. For example, a number of the crimes collected because of this geocoding problem happened at the Family Dollar, which is more than 1,050 feet away from the Annex Books building. So the district court thoroughly looked at that and took the 1,729 pages of all the 6 years of police reports that are Exhibit M2 in the record, and when properly analyzed, as both experts said that she could, supported the city's position because that was the most reliable information in the record. There are other ways of determining reliability, including the before and after analysis and a hotspot analysis, which provides a comparison to other businesses in the same circles. So essentially what the city did was what both experts endorsed. And the plaintiffs come up on appeal, and they want this court to sit in a super review position over the district court's thorough analysis, but they don't challenge any of that analysis. They don't say that she made a clear error. And the last point is on the restriction side of the equation, Your Honor. The district court found that there was no persuasive support at all in the record that the regulations substantially decreased the opportunity to disseminate expression. She found that, number one, there was no evidence that any publication or magazine or video was taken off the shelves or made unreliable to a patron. Number two, that there was no evidence that there was a patron who could only access this speech.
Well, except on Sundays and, you know, certain hours. Certainly,
Your Honor, there was a classic time, place, or manner regulation at play here, but she found there was no evidence that there was a patron who could only go during those hours. And number three, even after the injunction was entered, none of the businesses offered 24/7.
I'm puzzled by this line of argument. It implies that, for example, you could prevent the Indianapolis Star from publishing on Sunday, because, after all, it could put the same information in the Saturday and Monday papers. Is Indianapolis claiming that power?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. We're claiming...
Well, then why is it material that people, instead of going to the bookstore on Sundays, could go on Mondays?
Your Honor, it's material for the same reason that any time, place, or manner restriction is upheld.
Exactly. That's why I asked about the Indianapolis Star. Well, it's just a time, place, or manner restriction. We are stopping them from publishing on Sunday because there are always automobile accidents in the vans that deliver the papers, and they're harmful. And so cutting down newspaper distribution from 7 days to six will reduce injuries to the populace, and everybody can get the same news. And anyway, they can go on the web and see it there. And you thought that that would be a preposterous thing for Indianapolis to say. But it's what Indianapolis is saying about these plaintiffs.
Your Honor, it's not, because they have to have a substantial government interest, and they show that...
The substantial government interest I just articulated is cutting down the number of automobile accidents which kill and injure people.
But, Your Honor, there's nothing... The fact of the matter is the automobile accidents are not related to the dissemination of the speech.
Yes, they are. That's... You take papers and put them in trucks, you move them in trucks, and then they go in automobiles. Fathers may take their sons out to their newspaper routes. You can compute the number of automobile and truck miles that the daily distribution of a newspaper entails, and you're certainly not going to tell me that there are never accidents in the distribution vehicles of newspapers.
Of course not, Your Honor. But this breaks no new ground on what this court has repeedly upheld in Andy.
Look, you're not dealing with the essence of my question. I put to you a risk in distributing a daily newspaper, and then try to see how your argument applies to the distribution of the daily newspaper. And all you say is Indianapolis couldn't do that. That would be absurd, even if everybody can get the same news with only a six-day newspaper. What I'm trying to figure out is why Indianapolis thinks it can shut these bookstores, reduce them to, say, 6 days, in exchange, in order to reduce harm to people from crime, when it thinks the same argument with respect to a daily newspaper is absurd.
Your Honor, the reason that they can do that is because there's a qualitative difference. For example, if Domino's Pizza had a 30-minute or delivery less. If it just so happened that the Indianapolis Star had more accidents on Sunday, that's not necessarily related to the speech-related activity. It doesn't have the same secondary effects characteristics.
I'm totally lost. Automobile accidents, people being killed or injured in the streets, are a secondary effect of distributing newspapers. It's just a fact. It's a fact of life.
And Your Honor, there is, on that theory, the city, if the hypothetical were true, could argue that all cars have to be off the streets because every auto accident presents the same risk. But Your Honor, in this case, the facts show that crime was greatest at these bookstores, the severity of the crime was greater, and when the city did its restriction, which was adopted 3 years after the identical restriction was upheld by this court in Schultz, they actually had a substantial reduction in negative secondary effects. Under the reasonably believed to be relevant standard and the relaxed narrow tailoring standard of Ward versus Rock Against Racism, the restriction on speech, as found by the district court, under a clear error standard, there was no substantial diminution of speech. There was no reduction, any meaningful reduction in the access, especially since the businesses under the preliminary injunction could have operated 24/7 and chose not to. So the plaintiffs were limiting their own hours for market reasons, showing that most of the hours that they could have been open but chose not to, that are regulated by the ordinance, they weren't even open. So there was no significant reduction in speech. We're really talking about only a couple of the hours in the overnight hours because plaintiffs had already limited their hours of operation. Under the Supreme Court standard in Renton, as reaffirmed by Alameda Books, a substantial decrease in secondary effects, such as documented by the district court, and a negligible decrease, if any, by in the same environment as noted by the district court in her findings of fact, show that the city's regulation is constitutional. Both experts endorse the view adopted by the district court on the reliability of the data and looking at the address-specific crimes. And no court has said that the crimes that occur at an adult bookstore should be ignored, as the plaintiffs would suggest that this court should do. But in the final analysis, the city is not regulating core political speech as the Indianapolis Star, nor are they trying to regulate based on a hypothetical of perceived harm on a particular day of the week. Instead, the city produced hard data that was supported by both of the experts that showed that its regulation reduced secondary effects. And for that reason, we ask that this court affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Bergel. Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Your Honor. As Judge Flom's hypothetical demonstrates, it's no trick to reduce secondary effects by simply requiring businesses to shut down, or in his example, requiring the newspapers not to distribute the newspapers on that day. That violates Justice Kennedy's concurrence, and it violates what your opinions represented in the last two cases. But beyond that, the fact remains, despite all of the harping on the crimes at the bookstores, when you actually look at their exhibit, their M4, the one that they champion the most, there wasn't any substantial enough reduction to justify the curtailment of speech, which is the test. On Sunday at Lafayette Video, it went from one before to one after. Why should Lafayette be closed on Sunday on that basis? Newflix was 0-0. Keystone went from 5 down to 2 over a 34-month period. Why should it have to close on the basis of that kind of evidence on Sunday? In the midnight to 10 a.m., Keystone went from 3 to 3. Nothing. Why should it have to close when there wasn't even a reduction? Annex went from 3 to 1 in the 34 months after the ordinance went into effect at midnight to 10 a.m. Why should they have to close on that basis? On Sunday, there was one crime at Annex before the enforcement and zero. So there was a one crime reduction over 34 months. And yet they justify closing Annex Books that entire day. So it just doesn't make sense, Your Honor, that their evidence, which focuses on reducing the robberies at the bookstores, which, as Your Honors have already pointed out, it's their job to protect us from robbers, not close us down. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.